This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 26th of May 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
Our visit to Hiroshima will honour all those who were lost in World War II and reaffirm our shared vision of a world without nuclear weapons, as well as highlight the extraordinary alliance that we have been able to forge over these many decades.
In just a few hours' time, Barack Obama will become the first sitting US president to visit the site of Hiroshima. Should he apologise for what happened there? Also coming up, is France's government preparing to compromise on controversial labour reforms in order to avert a national crisis? And then...
Now the computer can draw a picture of what is supposed to be in the sky at any moment. It continually compares this expected picture with the real picture as seen by radar. If a flying object does not belong, it appears on this viewing screen.
We'll ask why the Pentagon is still using computers from the 70s to control some of its most important defense systems. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are Ivor Gaber, Professor of Journalism at the University of Sussex, and Tom Rivers, who's the London radio correspondent for ABC News. Ivor and Tom, welcome to you both. At 8:15 in the morning on the 6th of August 1945, a nuclear bomb was dropped on Hiroshima by an American bomber. The result was devastating. Around 80,000 people were killed instantly, and by the end of the year, tens of thousands more had died from their injuries or from nuclear fallout. The United States has never apologised for the attack, but when Barack Obama becomes the first sitting president to visit the city later on, many Japanese would like him to do just that. Tom Rivers, he's not going to, but at least some people will say the fact that he is visiting is a step in the right direction.
Certainly, 70 years, and he's the first one to do it. And 70 years down the road, it's interesting, I was looking at some polls the other day, Americans are still split, Ivor, literally almost 50-50 on whether it was a good decision, on whether it was a bad decision. So... That seems still quite high, given the length of time it's been. So, it's an interesting one, and it certainly will open a new chapter for the next president. We can get into that as well, on where America may be going come November.
Ivor Gaber, John Kerry recently visited and was very careful in his language about what he could express and what he couldn't express. And we can expect something similar from Barack Obama when he's there. The language will convey sympathy, but won't use the other S word.
Well, yeah, I think the president is going to be treading on eggshells, because the people he might will offend in the United States if he's seen to be sounding like an apology. Yep. And I suspect that I was going to say President Trump, what an awful thought. Anyway, passing on, candidate Trump will take full advantage of anything that sounds like that. But equally, he's treading on eggshells regionally, because the Chinese and the South Koreans will be listening very closely to hear if he's suggesting that somehow Japan was wronged during the Second World War. It is a very delicate mission.
And it's tricky, Tom Rivers. We'll come into this issue about apologies and when it's right and not in a moment. But it's particularly difficult for Barack Obama, because not just from Donald Trump, but from all strains of Republicans over the last 8 years, he's been accused of being someone who apologises for America. Now, you know, you need to sort of take what he said in a certain kind of way to suggest that might be true. But to Republicans, he is, in their eyes, a president who talks America down rather than talks it up.
We've heard that language. You talk to many Democrats and they'll say that this president for the past 8 years has been a centrist. He said some pretty progressive things. And he was here a couple of weeks ago and he said, well, I think my deeds have lived up to my words. And to the Sanders supporters in America, they say, that's not right, Mr. President. They're very, very different. Yeah.
But I think... A little premature, I know, but I think history will judge that certainly in foreign policy, Obama's significantly tilted, he changed American foreign policy in terms of whether this is the latest move, but the first president to visit Cuba,
yes.
The historic deal with Iran, whether you, people oppose it, this movement in Japan. I mean, his domestic achievements, perhaps apart from Medicare, might seem small, but I think in foreign policy, he's, you know, certainly with a Pacific tilt, he's made a significant impact.
And on that point, that Pacific tilt, much was made at the start of his presidency and when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State that the US was going to pivot towards Asia, and you know, they in a way they could try and pivot all they wanted, and they kept on getting dragged back to the Middle East. But certainly now, you know, after the Iran deal, it seems like he's trying to end on this pivot with the visit to Vietnam, this visit to Hiroshima.
Well, exactly. And what we got out of Vietnam was, okay, you know, we're gonna lift the arms embargo. Okay, and that doesn't help the 99% of Americans out there. It certainly helps the defense industry in America. This is about trade. I mean, every day there's another quote-unquote incident in the South China Sea. And, you know, they want to keep that open. This is all about trade. This is about multinational corporations in a way that the transatlantic agreement that's being maybe hatched by the end of this year is going to do the same thing over here. So this has a lot to do about entities that are corporations, the industrial complex, has very little to do with the man on the street.
But it's also, Tom, surely it's got an issue to do with geopolitics in the region as well. The reason why the US is willing to end the arms embargo in Vietnam and overlook some human rights abuses from the Vietnamese government is because they have a common enemy, and that's China.
Yeah. And that, you know, its economic might is growing by the year, and it's almost a growing tide. And Washington is doing what it can to try to stave off that. But again, that's going to be many, many, many years in the making, and we're seeing the beginning of it, as you say, though, with this president.
I want to look at this issue of apologies and when they're right and when they're not right, so when they can actually make a difference and when they can't. We've seen in Australia when Kevin Rudd was elected Prime Minister, he apologised to his nation's Indigenous population. We've seen here in the UK there were apologies by Tony Blair for slavery. There's been apologies by David Cameron for the actions of UK forces in Northern Ireland with the Bloody Sunday incident. There are times, aren't there, when an apology, you know, however long it's taken, is necessary.
I was going to start by saying I apologise, I don't have a view on this, but that would be right. I do have a view. I think you were edging towards it. I think this is a new theory I've just established. I think apologies work on the domestic front, but less so internationally. For example, in the UK, apologies over police treatment of Hillsborough, which was a great disaster and glowing crowds, or apologies about sex abuse that went unreported or nothing was done about it. That works, I think, particularly because it sort of captures a mood. I think international apologies work less often because there are not many nations that really wish to sort of bow down collectively and accept their collective guilt.
And is that because it's one thing for a political establishment to apologise to its own citizens, whereas if those same political leaders are apologising elsewhere, it's almost like they're apologising on behalf of all of us?
Indeed, indeed, indeed. It's a national thing as opposed to a governmental thing. I think when a nation, for example, there's been much debate in this country over many years as to whether the RAF during the Second World War bombed mercilessly German civilian populations, Dresden and so forth. And it's a very raw nerve because although many historians say absolutely RAF did terrible things to German cities, those are the very few of them left, but certainly the families of the British pilots who undertook the bombing are outraged by this because they were fighting an evil empire. and what was necessary, they did it. It's not dissimilar, actually, to the Hiroshima issue. So, no, I think it would be, it is difficult to apologise on behalf of a nation because there are many interests. So I think you're right, and I think it's an interesting issue.
Tom, do you think that, you know, we said at the start that in a sense, you know, Barack Obama can't win here. It's, you know, what he says won't be enough to make many in Japan feel like they've got what they want. And even if he says some things, there will be many people in the US who feel uncomfortable with it. Do you, you know, as an American, do you feel, you know, your countrymen and women would be comfortable with your president, whoever that may be, apologizing for anything that's happened in the past?
Yeah, and I think he's playing this one with a flat bat, and for the reasons you say, and demographically as well. This is kind of from left field, but for the first time ever, I think last month, millennials surpassed demographically their importance past the baby boomers. So it's a different generational thing. The millennials don't have that history, that baggage that the baby boomers have. So what didn't fly 20 years ago may well fly today and certainly will fly 20 years in the future.
And yet millennials don't vote and baby boomers certainly do.
They will be voting. They will be voting.
In 20 years' time, they'll be voting, but they can't be relied upon to vote now.
We'll see.
Okay.
We live in unique times.
We do indeed. Yes. Let's move on. Khadija Ismailova, an investigative journalist in Azerbaijan, was freed by the country's Supreme Court yesterday after spending 18 months in jail. Her crime? Well, she was convicted of corruption, but her lawyers believe she was framed because she was investigating the embezzlement of oil funds by government ministers. Ivor Gaber, I mean, this is a sort of a bittersweet victory. At least she's out, but she should never have been jailed in the first place.
No, and the situation with human rights and press freedom in Azerbaijan is pretty dire. There are signs that it might be getting better, but she was a symbol. She was an investigative journalist who was looking in particular at corruption. Government ministers, true, but they were all related to the president. She was looking at the president's family, and many people look at the president's family and wonder how they've become so suddenly rich and fabulously rich. The father was the president before the president, Aliyev, and it is a difficult country to sustain democratic values. I'm trying to tread with care because I worked in Azerbaijan with independent journalists of whom I have enormous admiration, particularly for Ismailov. I don't know if you're aware, probably the Secret Service, in order to try and stop her, put secret camera into her bedroom and filmed her having sex with her boyfriend and threatened her that they would put it on YouTube if she didn't stop her investigations. Mm. She didn't stop her investigations. And they put it on YouTube, and despite the humiliation, she carried on. Now, that takes courage. It's a symbol. There are still half a dozen journalists imprisoned in Azerbaijan and many opposition leaders. It's not a beacon of democracy, despite winning the Eurovision Song Contest or whatever.
No, indeed. And I'm glad you mentioned the Eurovision Song Contest there, because, you know, Tom Rivers, you know, they were able to use the hosting of that as a soft power boost. They also hosted the first ever European Games. Just over a year ago. Again, that was a way of them trying to, you know, use sport and soft power to give themselves an image boost. And, you know, they are, you know, Azerbaijan is an ally of the West, whether that's in the war of on terror or in many other things as well. We need their oil and gas.
Yes.
These are our good friends, aren't they? And they're locking up journalists.
Well, I tell you what, I mean, it's difficult. And as you say, if things are slowly changing, I guess we're not seeing a whole lot of that yet. But I tell you, in a lot, large parts of say, the States, it is really, really unknown territory. It's difficult to get a story. This story is going to be buried on page 45 on a broadsheet in maybe the New York Times. This is not going to be headline news.
But I do think Steve's point is well made. War on terror. It is in such a strategic position lodged between Russia, Iran. I think there's a bit of Iraq there as well. Turkey. Huge oil and gas reserves. I know British and American diplomats who I met with in Baku, the capital. They had a very difficult job because it is an ally. but it's not a very good friend.
Okay, we'll leave it there just for now. When we return, we'll be talking about a different type of journalism, and we'll also be heading to France as well. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the programme as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, a programme that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, still with me, Ivor Gaber and Tom Rivers. Now, Vice was supposed to be the future of journalism, but yesterday announced that 20 people were losing their jobs. The Telegraph Media Group here in the UK is supposed to be a bastion of journalism, but they got rid of several of their foreign correspondents yesterday as well. The New York Times, they announced that there will be voluntary redundancies. Ivor Gaber, obviously, we have some self-interest in this, in that all of us around the table are journalists. But we'll come on to in a moment sort of the broader picture and why it's so important. But this is an incredibly tough time for the industry, isn't it?
It is. It's an industry in utter flux, if you can have such a thing as utter flux. Now, we all thought the different models of online journalism, we would find ways of paying for it. I have to say, the FT, the Financial Times, seems to have cracked it a bit. And so does the Times, apparently. I don't know, haven't read in the figures, but seems to be making money behind the paywall. But in general, nobody's paying for news because it's all free. Mm-hmm. It's not really. And I think, interesting, the Vice story that you began with is very interesting, because that were Vice, BuzzFeed, Mashable were the new formats of journalism. That was all going to work. That was all very different. I did read an article the other day that suggested Facebook is just hoovering up everything. Mm. Facebook is destroying or recreating journalism, but it ain't paying for it.
No, indeed. And that's the problem, Tom Rivers, isn't it, with, for example, Facebook, is it is the platform that increasing numbers of people are going to for their news. But if, say, you're The Guardian, to pluck a name at random, and your story is read on Facebook, you're not getting any of the advertising dollars that Facebook's getting from that. You're not getting anyone coming to your site.
You are absolutely right. And how do you find the magic formula? It's not there. The Sun tried it, didn't they? They said, well, we're going to have you can pay for this. And people are saying, there must have been five people, I bet, probably, that signed up for that. It's free now again. It's a difficult one to crack. And, you know, we've seen a number of waves of the digital newsroom being cut back. And then it went quiet. We thought that was it. And looks like a second wave is appearing now. And when you say you're getting, say, rid of something like 55 people at the Telegraph, that hurts. That is a lot of history, a lot of years now that you're going to say goodbye to. I personally like Vice. I think they're edgy. I hope they can retain that quality. And I guess they're going to be transforming some of those jobs more into digital video, I guess, streams. But that's a whole new animal. And as you know, you deal with your students. Once upon a time, you got into this business and you were a newspaper man, you were a radio man, or you're a TV man, or you are now you are. The students coming out are well-versed in everything. They are very, very good. And most of them are freelancing right now as well.
I want to come on to you about student journalism in just a moment. But Tom, perhaps just briefly, if you're not a journalist, why does this matter?
Well, I get, you know, if you click on your Facebook, and you're absolutely right, and most of us do that probably every single day, hopefully you have the critical attention to say, well, where does the story come from? But if it's a reputable source, you kind of yak with your friends around the coffee machine. And you're not too worried about how that copy got there. and how many hands it went through, and if there's any advertising that's going to feed the person who plunked that story out in front of a PC, that's not in the front of your mind, is it?
Yes, but why? But so I'm asking you to explain, why should it matter then for, you know, that all these jobs are going at news organizations all over the world?
It should matter because the smaller the collective newsroom, the less context you have in stories, the more it's two graphs of something, and there you go, I know everything about fill in the blank. And that's where we're headed. And you have to have the attention to read a lengthy article if you really want to be informed. Some people don't want to be informed.
Ivor Gober, you teach journalism students. I guess, you know, the first question I'd ask, want to ask them through you is, why do they want to be journalists these days?
Shh, don't tell them. because it's an exciting, you know, despite all this doom and gloom, it's the best job in the world. You can be nosy, you can ask what you like, you can, within limits, write what you like. Always getting people to pay you for it is something different. And it's fun. It's also, just to answer the question in a different way that you put to Tom, it's important. It's about, I mean, just to sound slightly pretentious, it's about democracy, giving an informed electorate. Yeah. People, I mean, take Brexit. I won't go into it. I promise you I'm not going to talk about it. But, you know, it should be inconceivable that a major decision like this is taken without proper, well-informed public debate, whether it's highbrow in the Times or in the Sun. I will move on from Brexit because we could spend a long time on that. But I do think it's an important work, and we do stress that. We do say to journalists, okay, you've got to go and get a big story, but you've got to be responsible.
Okay, we'll move on. We've got two more stories to try and fit in before the bottom of the hour. Industrial action by union members at French oil refineries, nuclear power plants and ports is causing nationwide chaos. The country's Prime Minister, Manuel Valls, has said that labour reforms at the heart of the dispute would not be withdrawn, but suggested they could be modified. So is the French government preparing to pull off a somewhat uncomfortable U-turn to avert an even bigger crisis? Tom Rivers, it sort of looks that way, doesn't it?
Sort of looks like that, and especially looking at the calendar, we have the European Cup coming up, and you cannot have this unresolved. So I think you're going to have to pull out some kind of an answer from the compromise genie before, whatever, 2-3 weeks, because you cannot run into that kind of a competition and still have this not resolved. If that means rolling over, as far as the government is concerned, then so be it. At this stage of the game, though, there's still the to-ing and fro-ing going on.
And Ivor Gober, there's also a big challenge for the French government in that these reforms are seen as, they see are as necessary to boost the economy. And if they don't boost the economy, then the chances of François Hollande being re-elected are nil. And yet, equally, François Hollande and his various competitors within the Socialist Party have to appeal to the party right now, which is more left-wing than the country, to enable them to be the candidate in the first place.
I think Hollande is in an unenviable position. And for France generally, of course, there's the threat of the extreme right taking advantage of this, because Sarkozy and the centre-right hasn't got a strong candidate yet. Hollande is in a very weak position, the most unpopular French president since opinion polling began. And yeah, I think he has now alienated a lot of his base. The opinion polls in France are showing 60% of the French population support the strikers. This tradition of Labour solidarity is very strong, and Hollande has not cracked it. And yeah, I think with the unfortunately with the European Nations Cup starting in 2 weeks, he's going to have to U-turn at a pretty fast rate.
It's interesting, Tom, when you look at those figures of how much support there is for the strikers. It's often been said that, oh, well, you know, France needs to reform, you know, it needs to reform. And successive presidents and prime ministers on the left and the right have sort of tried and then perhaps not really done it. Alain Juppé back in the 90s tried and then was, you know, drummed very quickly out of office. Should we just accept that, you know, France doesn't want to reform?
That's part and parcel of French culture, French society. I've been spending a lot of time there, unfortunately, for bad reasons this past year, covering stories. And the French are the French. They this is what they do. This is not unexpected. To not strike would be unusual. And that's the way it is. And as you say, Hollande is in a bad place right now, and I think he has no alternative but to roll back.
But even people whose economic interests aren't necessarily on the same side of the strikers are supporting them. That's what's strange. Middle-class voters who stand to benefit from greater flexibility in the labour market, somehow or other, the tricolour running through their blood makes sure that when they see a trade union demonstration, they put their clenched fist up and say, solidarité.
Okay, now let's take a little listen to this.
This is where America's peace of mind begins. Around the clock, radars, electronic eyes watch the skies. The officer in charge makes the final decision. Fire.
Now, that's not as prehistoric as it may have actually sounded. It's transpired that a computer system used for controlling some nuclear weapons and missiles in the US dates back to the 1970s, so perhaps a little bit after that sound came from. The Government Accountability Office said that the Pentagon was one of several departments which urgently needed to replace outdated networks. Now, Tom Rivers, there's a serious point to this, isn't there, which is that, you know, a lot of infrastructure in the US has not been updated over the last 30, 40 years.
That is scary. You and I, in the workplace, it's bells and whistles. Oh, you got to go from Windows 5 to 7 to 10 because of the sky's going to fall if you don't. And you're dealing with 8-inch floppies that are the control system, I guess, for the intercontinental ballistic missile system. That is, you know, for as a non-IT guy, I would think that is scary, and all the alarm bells, security alarm bells, should be going off. Also, to the taxpayer in America, this report, I guess, says that something like $61 billion, with a B, is spent on maintaining this ancient technology. So if everybody on the planet has to upgrade their systems, why not this? This is an anomaly.
You might call it anomaly. I call it very clever, because I think it, modern day hackers.
Well, maybe that's
trying my goodness me, what is this?
They won't know how to hack
into
it.
No idea. What is a floppy?
It's like a foreign language, I guess.
They'll go to antique shops to try and find old computers. No, I think it's brilliant. I think it's a double bluff. They've done it deliberately for security reasons. I would sleep more soundly in my bed tonight knowing I am protected by 8-inch floppy disks.
And I guess also, Ivor, there is the argument, the sort of semi-serious argument, that if you don't have to upgrade your IT systems all the time, then at least the people that understood it in the first place don't have to keep learning new systems.
Yeah, unfortunately, most of them are going to be dying soon. Yeah, that's the problem. And once they go. But I do think there's an interesting point here, but sometimes things that we regard, and I'll give you another example, as completely redundant and old technology. Vinyl is now back. Vinyl, 8-inch floppy disks. Will we go back to wind-up gramophones?
I know, but okay. I know what you mean about vinyl, but that's because it sounds good. That's not because it's sort of, there's some sort of security system where it sort of, it works better. Tom Rivers, the more you sort of dig deep into sort of how US government works, the more you realise that it's not as up to date as it perhaps should be. There are all sorts of issues with the Department of Veteran Affairs, for example, where there are their entire floors of their building filled with paperwork because none of it has been computerized.
The priorities, and it goes to the priorities, and the fact that every budget that comes through Congress is generally filled with pork, meaning that my programs are funded. If Ivor Saar, well, that's up to him, but you got to fight your own case, and everybody does. And if it had been, if it were more logical, you would have more money for the VA. And you can go to every VA across America, you'll hear the same story. Come on, you're not doing a very good job here. And, but you have money for other things. You know, we have the new F-35, which is somewhat can fly, and it costs billions, and it's where are the priorities? It's skewed. It's in my view, it's not correct right now.
Okay. I'm afraid we're going to have to end it there, unless you had another analog anecdote, which is you can fit in the next 15 seconds.
All governments are made up of silos, and one silo manages to retain its paperwork. it does does better than all the rest, and that's how it works.
Okay, there we are. Tom Rivers and Ivor Gaber, thank you both very much for joining us on Midori House. That's all we have time for on today's programme. It was produced by Rhys James, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hannah Ritchie. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. A bit of music next. Then at 1900, it's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. Do stay tuned for that. More on the day's top stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 London time. Midori House back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 in London, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.